G'day, Oshie Ginsberg here. Thanks for downloading the show. Hey, look, I know I said Emmanuel Kelly was going to be on the show on Monday, but I got a last-minute opportunity to interview Lance Piccioni about his incredible charity, Love Me, Love You, and a humongous cycling challenge he's undertaking, and it's this weekend. So I wanted to get the conversation. So we'll get to Emmanuel next week. So just a heads up about that, if you're waiting for Emmanuel, that'll be next week. You might hear an ad right now. If you do, thanks. You're helping me keep the lights on. If not, you'll hear Lance just drop some wisdom.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The life that I lived for such a long period of time, I hurt a lot of people with my choices that I was making, and I understand that. And I think that it was for me about bringing it back to make up for those choices. And by sharing the story and getting it out there and, you know, sharing the connection, knowing the fact that the reason I started the foundation was to make sure that other people didn't go through the crap that I did. And however that works with people, I know the work that we've done at the foundation over this last 8 years has changed many people's lives. It's saved lives. I feel better every time I do share my story, and that, you know, we use the power of storytelling a lot, but it's tiring. It is extremely tiring, but I love what I do because I know that the fact is that in the end of the day, yes, we don't save everybody's life, but that's not physically possible, right? But the fact is that we know that we change people's lives in a way that is positively better.
That is former professional football player, cyclist and CEO of the Love Me, Love You Foundation, Lance Piccioni. And this is Better Than Yesterday. G'day, I'm Oshie Ginsberg. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is Better Than Yesterday, a bi-weekly podcast where twice a week, three times a week now, I hope to try to help you make today better than yesterday. That's it. Something that you hear on this show will help you make today better than yesterday. That's a guarantee. Been here since 2013. Mondays and Wednesdays, I'm here with a guest. Fridays, I'm here with you. As I mentioned earlier, I did say Emmanuel Kelly was going to be on the show this week, but I got the opportunity to interview Lance Piccioni ahead of his Everesting challenge, which I'll tell you about in a second. And I wanted to make sure I got it up and got it to air before he attempted that, because he deserves all the support he can get. And as well, you know, it's in support of a charity ride I myself am doing this weekend, which I'll tell you a bit more about in a moment. If you've never listened to the show before, I'm Osher. I'm a TV host. I'm an author. I'm a podcaster. I ride bicycles. I lift heavy things. I'm a dad. I'm a stepdad. I'm the father, I guess, I don't know. What do you call it? We have two cavoodles who have actual names, but we call them Licky and Barky. And I've finished Ted Lasso. And I feel happy and sad at the same time. If you need to get in touch with me, super easy, send Osher email at gmail.com. That's where you can find me. I'd love to hear from you. Let me tell you about my guest today. Lance Piccioni is a former AFL football player. He played with Adelaide for 2 years, and he played for 5 years for Hawthorn, played 58 games with Hawthorn. His father was a former professional soccer player in Australia, and Lance went on to play AFL, which for reasons he'll go into. Lance goes into great detail in this conversation about the whirlpool that he fell into of drugs and alcohol to cope with the stresses that he was dealing with in his life, to a point that led to him being in such a horrible, horrible, horrible place. This is the part of the show where I tell you we're going to talk about suicidality. So if you need to talk to someone, I would recommend Lifeline 13 11 14. If you need to talk to someone in a hurry. If not, talk to your GP. It starts with a conversation with your GP, and you may get referred to a psychologist, which is okay, and a psychiatrist, which is also okay. Because as I've said many, many times before, you can't think your way out of a problem brain using the same brain that needs help. It just doesn't work like that. Yeah, you kind of need outside help. And that's what Lance is all about. I absolutely adored speaking with Lance. He's a fascinating guy. He's intensely passionate about helping people. He absolutely saw the edge of the abyss, and he found his way back. And his mission in life is to guide others back from that edge. lovemeloveyou.org.au is where you can go to find out more about the foundation that Lance is the CEO of, a foundation that runs a bunch of, you know, workshops and programs for people to, you know, basically help one-on-one peer support and mental health first aid. And they're doing really, really great work. Such great work, in fact, that I am very, very proudly riding on the 31st on Halloween. I'm going to do a ride on Zwift. It's a virtual ride. So if there's absolutely anyone in your life that has their bike hooked up to Zwift or wants to come and ride a virtual ride with me, Sunday, the 31st of October, just come and jump on the ride. It's going to be great. I'm going to be live streaming it on Twitch. Hot Dub Time Machine is going to be my DJ. I'm going to have special guests. We're going to spend about 2 hours. Even if you don't ride, just come and join me on the Twitch stream. It's going to be a shitload of fun. We're going to have a great time. There's two rides. There's a 50K, which you'll probably ride. You know, it might be super intense, but it'll, you know, you'll know that you rode. And there's a 20K, which is just a casual roll the legs over. But it's just something that you can do while you enjoy the conversation that's happening on the Twitch stream. For more details, there's a link in my Instagram. And just keep an eye on my Instagram. I'll put up all the details about the, you know, how to join the ride and how to be a part of it. If you want to support me and help me raise funds for Love Me, Love You, I never ask you to help me raise funds. You know, I ask you to donate. I guess, no, it's not true. I haven't asked you to donate to anything since FRRR during all the Black Summer bushfires. So I'm really hoping that if you have a couple of spare bucks, just pop to my Instagram profile. You'll find the link in the bio there. And if you throw a few bucks the way of Love Me, Love You, you'll really help the work they're doing. If you watch the documentary that I was a part of making that was on SBS, it was all about suicide prevention. And that is absolutely what Love Me, Love You do. They are on the ground, boots on the ground, providing really powerful and really effective mental health interventions to people in need. And I'd really love you to help them out. Lance is doing a huge challenge to raise money the day before on the 30th of October as part of the Ride With Me weekend. Runs across essentially Melbourne Cup weekend. Lance is doing a thing called Everesting, which is riding your bicycle the equivalent vertical meters of Mount Everest. So just imagine that. If you live on a hill, you'll understand. You remember hill ratios from maths in high school. So if the bottom of the hill is, you know, at sea level and the top of the hill is 10 meters above sea level and it's 100 meters long, that's a 1 in 10. All right. So for every 100 meters you ride, you've gone up 10 meters. That's a 10% grade. You know, you understand what I'm saying? That's a pretty hefty hill. That's a good hill. So imagine that. Imagine that 800 and 900 times. Okay. That's what Lance is doing. It's going to take him about 14 hours. And he's raising money for lovemeloveyou.org.au. So we'll get right into that. Like I said, I would love you to come and join me on the ride on Halloween. Just keep an eye on my socials. I'll post more details about that. But it's going to be on Zwift on Halloween, 11 a.m. Eastern Summer Daylight Saving Sydney time. So whatever that is, wherever you are in NT, Queensland and South Australia. Or WA, anywhere that's not New South Wales and Victoria, let's be honest. Hobart, oh God, daylight saving. Oh, I'm so scattered this afternoon. Sorry, I just trained and my head's all over the place. So without further ado and more confusion from me, enjoy this conversation with Lance Piccioni. How are you today, Lance? You okay?
Yeah, good.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's all good. Yeah, life's good, mate. I've been up and training, a little bit of homeschool, and here I am, and then I've got to do some more training after this. So,
are you training for anything?
Part of next weekend, I'm doing a virtual Everest. Yeah. So the last sort of 3 months has been a pretty berserk sort of training program, working through that. 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock mornings start sort of stuff. Yeah, so in the garage, because once we haven't been able to ride outside past 5Ks or 15Ks, it was recently, and now this week is sort of unleashed. But so, yeah, so virtual Everest is what it is.
It's 8,846,
9 reps up the Alp. Just to make sure.
So just for people who've never ridden a bicycle, there's a couple of landmark milestones for bicycle riding. There's the Century, which is 100 miles, 171 kilometres. Yep. There's the Metric Ton, which is 100 Ks. And then there's the Everest, which is the equivalent of riding your bicycle up Mount Everest, which is, as Lance mentioned, over nearly 9,000 vertical metres, which is a lot of climbing.
Yeah. Good times. Good times. It's interesting, man. Like, you know, many people have tried it and failed and given up, but many people have done it as well, right? So it's one of those things you tick off a list, and I've been told many times, mate, that I'm an idiot and stupid for doing it. And what am I thinking? Because I only took up cycling a couple of years ago, and I'm built like a fridge, so it actually works better for me to do a virtual Everest than actually do a proper one. So it's going all right. I'm looking forward to it, actually.
Athletics is nothing new to you. You've had a professional football career, and your father before you was a professional soccer player. Do you remember as a kid going to see your dad play? He represented Australia.
Yeah. I remember. So he was a Socceroo 79-80, around that sort of time. And
wow.
I was born in 1980, so long time ago. And then it was I remember going to the soccer. I don't remember watching. Like, as in actually him playing and doing what the things, but you remember the little things of, we keep talking about the culture around it was more about what the food was and the food that we used to go and get. And it used to be big chavapchi rolls, chavapchi and cabbage rolls. And that was the thing that I remember from it. But, you know, he played for a long time and doesn't talk about it a lot, but he, a very humble man and usually humble man in how it goes about it, but can shoot you down. If you're trying to talk yourself up, he can bring out the articles and all that sort of stuff to make sure that you know that he was a superstar, right? And he still is. So
that's so cool, man. That's so, with that mindset, do you, like, when you were little, would, you know, was keeping active a part of what it was to go and play with dad?
Yeah, a huge part. Like, we started playing basketball. I started playing basketball when I was like 4 years of age, playing underage mixed basketball with a volleyball on an 8-foot ring. And mum and dad were hugely into that and making sure, you know, for my brother and my sister and I, that, you know, sport, using the vehicle of sport to be connected and, you know, part of the communities and all that sort of stuff. But we loved it. We loved everything about any type of sport. It had a ball, nothing to do with rackets or bats or anything like that. That wasn't our thing because it became too aggressive, probably. So balls were our thing. And then so basketball, but we didn't play soccer growing up. And purely it's based around the culture. The culture back then, in the 80s, my brother played and played for a couple of years in under 10s and 12s, that sort of space, under 10s. But he was getting, like, abused and all that sort of stuff from other parents and supporters and all that sort of stuff as an under 10 because of my dad and who he was. And dad just said, no, this is not how we're going to go about it. Which is unbelievable because people always say, why didn't you play soccer? And it was pretty much because it wasn't allowed, just because of the culture that was around it. So we didn't do that. And then we said basketball. And then I started a new school in grade 6, and the boys introduced me to footy, and that became the thing. So dad and I still have the debate over footy versus soccer and, you know, the contact versus the non-contact sport sort of thing. Now it all goes about it and skill levels and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, it's interesting conversations that it is, but I think it's about, you know, the driving that work ethic an understanding of what it takes to achieve something was what Dad really sort of instilled into us.
It's pretty epic that your father, soccer meant so much to your dad.
Yeah.
But it didn't mean so much that what I want my kids to get out of sport is more important than the sport they play. So kids, you're not going to play this one. Yeah. Because that's a huge thing for a dad to do.
Huge. I mean, no more. Yeah, even more now, understanding that as a parent myself, looking at what that is for my kids. Like even Dad, like when he was playing soccer here, he was offered so many contracts and all that sort of stuff to go back to Europe and play, but he wanted to bring his family up in Australia because of the opportunities and freedoms and choices that we all have that, you know, that everyone's fighting against at the moment. But working through that process to say, okay, well, this is what's more important for my kids is to enjoy what they're doing and to drive themselves to an ability to do what they want to do. And if it's music or dramas or acting or whatever it is, and sport was our thing. You know, as I said, that was a, and we love sport, and we know the vehicle, as I said before, about the power of playing sport and being around other people while doing it.
You started playing professional football right out of high school. Like you were 18. You straight into it.
Yeah.
That's a goal, crazy. like a dream for some kids. And you was like, did it ever seem like there would be any other thing that you would do?
Not really. I had this conversation the other day. I made my debut round one, 1998, and I was 17 and 8 months.
Far out.
So
my eldest is older than that right now.
Yeah. So, but that was the world, right? And like I started having conversations with AFL clubs when I was 13.
Wow.
But that was my world. And someone said, you know, was it a dream and all that sort of stuff? It became an expectation that I was always going to play. You know, I was sort of state captain and winning national awards and all that sort of stuff through the junior days. And it was just that expectation of not so much if, but when. And there's a difference between getting drafted, because so many people get drafted, and in the AFL system, you're lucky if you get a second contract, right? And then, you know, the average AFL career is 2.5 years. For every person that gets drafted, right? So you talk about, and that's probably gone up a bit because blokes like Sean Burgoyne has played for 48 years, so it's probably increased that average. But, it, you know, the dream that it was, the reality versus the dream's a lot different. You know, once you get there and the work and effort and discipline, all that sort of stuff that is needed to get the best out of yourself and be supported to do it.
Man, I can't imagine. I was 17 when I started working in the world, and I started as a roadie. So I'm fresh out of high school. I'm 17 and a half, and I'm working with road-hardened men in their 30s that drink hard. And I'm like this kind of wide-eyed high school kid, and suddenly I'm in a van with dudes.
What was that like for you
suddenly been around this culture of like, well, now you are, you know, you might be a rookie, but this is what we do. This is what we do as men. This is how we party, and this is how we handle problems.
I firmly entrenched myself in that sort of culture really quickly, and you had no choice. You know, I got drafted to Adelaide, of all places, as a 17-year-old to go to, which is an interesting place, the city in itself. But I shared a locker right next to a bloke called Darren Jarman. He's as manly as you'll get, and probably didn't fit the stereotypical professional athlete sort of body and ways of doing things, but was an unbelievably skillful man. And, you know, blokes with Mark Trudeau and Sean Rann and Andrew McLeod, and sort of got right into it and living that lifestyle. Because when I first got drafted, it wasn't so much the young man's game. It was you had to be a seasoned, hardened man person to play footy, and that was at that level. For me, I was a early developer, so I was sort of, I was a man child, so I was fully grown at, you know, 11 and a half, 12 years of age, right? So it's, and then working into that, it's just a crazy world of understanding the difference now, yeah, as I said, growing up and seeing what it's about, how different people management is, right, and the different sort of personalities and all that sort of stuff that come out and ability to do that. But it was, the old days was you worked hard, he partied hard, and that was the world. And even from an AFL position, these guys, they trained as hard as possible. They played hard on field and off field. And you had no choice but pretty much to be a part of that as well.
And when it came to, you know, obviously now your focus is on the charity Love Me, Love You and a healthy mental space. I mean, people call it mental health, but a mental fitness or a healthy mental space is dealing with adversity, dealing with problems. When you were in that, how did you see guys dealing with problems? An obvious one would be you train so hard and you got beaten by one behind, you're down and you lose the game. Like, how did you see guys dealing with disappointment, dealing with things that didn't go their way?
As a young person, you didn't look at it. You're just like, oh, that was footy, that was game, bang, you lost, you get on with it, you move forward. You understand different levels of disappointment. But as a young person, you think you're invincible. Losing doesn't come into your mind, sort of dealing with adversity like that, because it's the same thing. It's about working through those different experiences, creates that experience of understanding how you're worth through it. So, you know, losses and challenges and injuries and politics that comes with footy, or, you know, life that comes with social expectations, all that sort of stuff, as you're going through, it's creating a position of being able to understand how you talk through those positions. Because back in the late 90s, early 2000s, as the culture around football clubs, you didn't talk about things. You didn't. And you couldn't, because if you did, you may as well just walk straight back out the door. And which was just, you know, for a lot of people, that's all they knew. So they dealt with that and they moved forward and they kept going forward. But as a young person coming through, I'm not understanding that, because we as a family, we're very open, you know, from when I was growing up, very open about talking, yeah, more to my mum sort of thing, you know, that sort of motherly figure, talking about the experiences and feeling that. Not so much with dad, but that was the culture, right? Yeah, and different guys work through adversity differently, and some sort of sank their adversity challenges at the bottom of a bottle. Some got themselves hardcore into training and do that sort of stuff. As a young person, I took the way of alcohol to deal with that adversity sort of stuff, which became a real big challenge in my life. And, you know, a lot of regrets come with the choices that I made with that when I was in Adelaide, you know, and you're treated like a king. Right? When I got drafted to Adelaide, three team town, it's all happening. There's not much else happening in Adelaide, and you were just treated like a king. You could do whatever you wanted, wherever you wanted, to whoever you wanted, and you weren't kept accountable for those choices. And working through that, you know, I was waking up on the park benches in the middle of Rundle Mall, after passing out some big nights of drinking, that sort of stuff, and that was just. But those were the choices that I had made. That was the escape that I was trying to live, pretty much. And that sort of took its toll. And it took its toll really hard. Then you see it's usually too late before you appreciate what that is. I made that choice by that time to say goodbye to Adelaide and come back to Hawthorn, which was awesome.
You're a young man doing that. You're like 19, 20 years old. It's not uncommon behavior for someone who's 19 and 20, who's just kind of figuring out, well, this much vodka is fun. This much vodka means I don't remember what happened. So it's not uncommon for people to do that. But you had this profile where I lived in Adelaide in 98. I worked at SAFM at the time, and I know what you're saying. I worked in radio when I really paid for dinner. You know, I know what you're talking about. I know exactly the Crows Port. They were just you wouldn't have paid for a beer for years. You know, it's just
that was the lifestyle. Like.
Yeah,
but I take a lot of learnings from it now.
Yeah,
right. You know, it's always the whole hindsight thing. But you know, if I had to change things, could things have been differently? Could my career have worked out differently? It's probably a good thing that I got out of Adelaide after 2 years. Because, you know, I enjoyed the experience, but my career wasn't going anywhere. There'd become politics involved with like coaching levels and management. I need to be back with my family. My mental health issues had really escalated to a point. When I say mental health issues, not knowing the resource and the education and the awareness around it, because undiagnosable symptoms and diagnosis, but I needed to be with my family, because I knew that at that stage, if I didn't get back to what made me who I was at that time, my life could have been done, because it's not about the drinking, that is the choices that come with that, right? You know, drink driving, all those sorts of things, because you think you're invincible, you know, and those sort of choices could be fatal when you think about it.
Oh, mate, I tell people all the time that I have an allergy to alcohol. if I drink, I break out and fuckwit. That's my joke. But the truth is, like, the way I talk about it is that if you have a kid with a peanut allergy, you wouldn't even give him the smallest amount of peanut. You wouldn't give him a trace element of peanut, you know? There's some kombucha I can't drink because it has a tiny little bit of alcohol in it, right? But what happens if I have an allergic reaction. If I have even the smallest amount of alcohol, it changes how much I think is a good idea to drink, what I think is right and wrong, what's a good idea to do next, my moral compass. That's my allergic reaction. It changes who I am and how I feel about things. And the choices I make in that space are choices that I am grateful that I now no longer make.
Same thing. Like, I don't drink. And the problem that we have with in our society now, that when you say you don't drink, it becomes a you get judged. Right? What do you mean you don't drink? We can't have a couple of beers. I don't want to. I don't need to. I don't need that for me. My wife's not doesn't drink either, so that makes it easier again to work through that narrative. But I don't drink because, as I said, the choices that you make, it blocks your filter. Right? So I believe it blocks your filter to make more positive choices than not. 100%. You know, the guys that get the courage in the bottle and all that sort of stuff, and they become more sort of loose and they're allowed to sort of do that sort of thing. But for me, it doesn't work. And it's the same thing for you. It just doesn't work for me. I recently went to have a beer. I had a great week and everything was going well. And, I had a beer in the fridge from a parcel that one of those grazing boxes that someone sent to us. I thought, I'll see what this is about again, right? So I haven't had to drink for a long, long time, and I had a mouthful, and it was just, I felt like I was just going to crumble back into the couch and not come back out again. I just didn't like it, didn't enjoy it. And I said that there's social expectations, because then people sort of go, okay, well, we can't really invite them to the pub or to dinner or this sort of thing, because I want to sit back and have a couple of bottles of wine, and Lance is going to sit across from me and have his water all night. How does that make me feel, you know, for that person? So it's an interesting experience when you start talking like that, because it does create sort of segregation in the ways you go about it. And I understand the culture and people's needs that they do their certain things, and that's fine. You got your own choices. I make my own choices for me and my family, and that's all that matters for me.
When you've been using to deal with problems, when you've been using as a way of dealing with whatever mental things going on with you, you kind of don't notice. When you suddenly stop using, and this is my experience, it was like what I've heard people talk about, I came off my meds and everything went to shit. What was it like trying to deal with the discomfort, deal with uncomfortable things, deal with just the problems of life without alcohol there to anaesthetize it?
Well, alcohol was replaced by drugs, so that was another level of trying to deal with things. And that was the world. Like, I did it a couple of years when I was at Hawthorne. You know, I was sort of totally off alcohol, and, you know, I was fairly entrenched in my health and my fitness and my training and lots of stuff, and making the right choices and doing all those good things. And then certain issues come up and back on the wagon sort of thing. And then, as I said, replaced it with drugs. And you want to talk about something that creates a different filter in your choices and making choices. For 6 to 7 years, I was that was my world. And you talk about trying to deal with adversity, you don't deal with anything when you're on the gear. You're invincible to everything. And people go, oh, what about when you come down? Well, you don't come down, you keep going up. You keep taking something. It was, you know, for a long period of time, I started taking gear when I was playing at North Melbourne, you know, on weekends doing that sort of thing. That was my lifestyle. And I don't really remember that last year at North Melbourne when I was playing there, which is quite concerning. That sort of hazy lifestyle that I was living. And then, the next 5-6 years after that, you know, substances was just normal. That was the thing. Like, you got something? Let's go. And that was an everyday thing. But I was functioning. And this is the problem where we have, you know, through alcohol, through gear, through substances, through mental illness. So people, when they talk about the fact that you're still functioning, they don't think anything is wrong. But we know that there's usually not too many positive ways or outcomes that come from your lifestyle if you're going down that track. And then once it cleared, the 3 months after I went cold turkey on the substances was hell. It was absolute help, just because, one, and people are thinking this is a crazy, like, negative, but I actually started having thoughts, right? I actually had, there was some clear thinking, and there was just, the mind just going everywhere, and I couldn't process it because it had been so numb for so long, and I couldn't process it, and I couldn't sleep, I couldn't do anything, I didn't understand how to function, and then it just sort of went, and it just day by day, it just sort of got better, and being able to sort of open your mind up to different opportunities and being and doing and who you're doing that with. The people that I did things with back in the day are not bad people. People just make – we all make poor choices for certain things that we do in our life, and you move on. And, you know, I've just disconnected from a lot of those people from that period of time, a lot of them, talking about like 95% of them, and, you know, open yourself up to open opportunities of doing and understanding what you do for yourself and what is the legacy you want to leave on your day. And I think this is the biggest thing that I've learned. It's what footprint do you want? What impression do you want to leave on your day? It's, you know, people just sort of get stuck in the rut of life and keep doing it. And then they turn to alcohol, they turn to drugs, they turn to being promiscuous, they turn to all these sorts of things to try and fill a hole of not feeling any connection in their day or why they go about certain things. You know, and I'm coming up 10 years sober from the substances, as I said, alcohol. You know, we don't even have alcohol in our house. We don't, don't go out to sort of pubs or anything like that. I'm very uncomfortable in those situations. But the choices that I make are for what I want to do, from not just for me, but for my family, which are the most important things in my life.
You were in your early 30s when you decided, you made the choice to no longer drink and use.
Yeah.
People ask me about my moment, and I'm like, look, there wasn't a moment. There was just a day I woke up when I just can't fucking do that again, because it's the same every time. It's never different, and I want something different in my life. That was it. It wasn't like driven out of some gigantic, thankfully, I know people who have had to get sober after they've woken up with a cop, you know, putting their head in the car window going, you've just fucking hit someone. They just woke up out of a blackout in a car, you know, and that was the catalyst. I'm lucky that didn't happen to me. It well and truly could have. But it was just, I just woke up one morning and I just can't fucking do it again, because it's the same every fucking time. Was it like that for you? Was it just a moment where you're like, I'm sick of this?
It was a series of moments and experiences. And I'm talking a series over probably 5 years.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
And it all just went, okay, this is it. You know, I had my last suicide attempt it's actually coming up next week will be my 10th anniversary.
Wow.
My last suicide attempt.
Jesus, man.
So that's a bit of a wake-up call to life. You know, I was sitting on a roof of the place I was living at, and I talk about the suicide attempt. We lived in a big sort of party house at that time, and, you know, sort of three levels up, and sitting on there during the day, high as a kite for hours on end, just thinking this is it. And somehow I got off, and people ask why I got off. I don't know. There's no reason. I just did. Got down and went inside and smoked more joints and all that sort of stuff to say, okay, well, we'll worry about this tomorrow, sort of thing. And woke up feeling like absolute crap. And my wife now, who was my girlfriend at the time, just had a general conversation with me to say what's going on. Like, you know, I was scared at the time, you know, because genuinely I hadn't slept for a few days, but I hid that, and, you know, nobody sort of realized that. So you can sort of wake yourself through actually fake sleeping, sort of thing. You sort of become pretty good at that. And I didn't recognize myself in the mirror. Like, I just genuinely, I looked like absolute shit. It was just, the eyes were so sunken, the skin was terrible. My vision was blurry. It was just like, oh, well, I said to my wife, I need some help. Like, this is not good. And this was in October, end of October. I finally then saw my doctor, who I had a good relationship with, probably about a month later. And then we started that plan. It's like, saw a range of different psychologists. Psychologists weren't doing shit for me because it's just fluffing all the things about. And, you know, I rocked up to my first psychology session stoned, which is not a pretty good idea. And then okay, was the choices I had to make, moved out of the house and saw a psychiatrist at the Melbourne Clinic down here, which is a pretty renowned sort of drug and psychiatry clinic down here, and just said, okay, this is the choice I need to make, and went cold turkey, and that was it, you know, and started putting that stuff in. And, I was reading a lot of Buddhism books at the time. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not like a, you know, beast. I'm not floating around wearing fisherman pants and all that sort of stuff. That's not my world. But I was reading that to try and research the fact of what can you do? What can I do for myself? And that became my world. And, you know, getting right into that and journaling a lot. I'm not sure if you journal much, but I was just sitting in cafes just for hours on end throughout the days, just writing down everything that was going on, right from my earliest memories, from the goods, the bads, everything that has come with it. And working through that process for me, I believe saved my life, because my psychiatrist said to me, he goes, the problem that we have with drugs and mental illness is that people want to treat the effect, right? If you treat the effect, you're going to relapse and you're going to be back here again and again and again. What's the cause? Why are we here? Why are you in this position? And then putting it back and acknowledging that, because and that's the hardest thing. People don't acknowledge their shit, right? And if you don't acknowledge your shit, it becomes your issue and your challenge, and you're sort of not dealing with it. And it's you sweep it under the rug and you keep putting it away, because you sort of don't want to open yourself up to the vulnerabilities of dealing with it. And, you know, there's many days that I was, you know, sitting on park benches crying and all that sort of stuff, and realizing what my world had become, and realizing the fact that, you know, if I had have jumped off, or I had have gone back and smoked more pipes and taken more pills and all that sort of stuff and jumped in a car or whatever it might have been. Reality is an amazing thing if you allow yourself to be a part of it. It's nuts.
But I'm so grateful to hear that you were able to have that moment of clarity, that, you know, to see that you needed help. And I'm also really grateful for the woman that's now your wife, that she was able to communicate to you in a way, because I'm sure she wasn't the first person that had mentioned this is a problem, but she was clearly able to cut through. She was clearly able to find a way to speak to you with kindness and compassion and empathy.
Which is really bizarre, right?
Yeah, it is, right?
Because, you know, speaking about it now, because, you know, she's heard me talk many times about the experience, and she's like, oh, I don't really remember having that conversation with you. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, you did. Well, that's my side of it, because there's always three sides to the story, right? Yeah. So it's my side, your side, and what actually happened. So
what role did she play in your journey to get from where you were to where you wanted to be?
Huge role. Just, I think it was just a person to be opening the doors to opportunities of things that can happen in your life. There was no pushing, there was no demanding, just a person that I could be myself with whatever I needed to be at that time. You know, my wife was a most beautiful, caring, empathetic person you'll ever meet in your life, who comes without judgment. There's no bias, there's no nothing with her that complicates. There's no complications. And I think that we come in a world that life's complicated, and it's complicated because people make it complicated. Right? So in terms of our social connections and all the things that go with it, and everyone wants to bitch and moan and you know, whinge about something and complain about something or cause drama. But there's no drama with my wife. She is just what she is, and she just likes her people. You know, she has strong family, you know, which is, I think, is a big connection that we have and still have to today, is, you know, we come from strong families in terms of our relationships in there, which we're very lucky to have, which I know a lot of people don't have, but we sort of carry that through. We make sure that us now as a family, we understand who we are as people. Didn't try to change. When people get into relationships, right, and they go into a relationship and they go, oh, I'm going to change you for what I want you to be, which, come on, right? And then you're sort of stuck in a position in your relationship, you know, 10 years down the track with a person that you're not yourself, and you're with a person that's like, who the hell is this, right? You wake up one morning and then you're like, oh, geez, you're still here. But she wasn't trying to change me. I'm not trying to change her. We do our thing, and we have, like, I have my life, she has her life, and we have our life together. And I think that's really sort of trying to find that balance, which does take time.
It's a beautiful thing. I'm really happy for you, mate. There's a point where you started understanding that you're a person of profile. You've had some high profile moments where the choices you'd been making, the public were aware of some of those choices you'd been making. What did it mean to you to start doing public things basically in the opposite direction, like the time you walked from Sydney to Melbourne? What did it mean to you to start doing big public displays of, I'm doing something different now?
Yeah, it's berserk. Like, it's the crazy lifestyle choices of things that I was doing and being. Like, as much as my life is public, I'm actually quite private. I'm extremely private in who I am and how I go about it. And I'm very public. Right? Does it make sense? Like, understand. The walk from Sydney to Melbourne wasn't for anybody else but for me. And I say that in the nicest way because I nearly lost my leg a couple of months before my last suicide attempt. I had a ruptured patella off the bone in my kneecap, and kneecap was halfway floating up my leg. I had infections from the operation, all that sort of stuff. Walking became my thing. And I set myself a challenge to do this. And the attachment that it came with starting the foundation was something that I did because the life that I lived for such a long period of time, I made some choices and I hurt a lot of people with my choices that I was making, and I understand that. And I think that it was for me about bringing it back to make up for those choices, and by sharing the story and getting it out there. And walking from Sydney to Melbourne was fun, but it was not something that I would suggest people do again because it's berserk and there's some boring parts of that walk. Anyway, sharing the connection, knowing the fact that the reason I started the foundation was to make sure that other people didn't go through the crap that I did. And however that works with people, I know the work that we've done at the foundation over this last 8 years, 8.5, coming up 9 years, has changed many people's lives. It's saved lives, but there's also people that have slipped through the gaps. It's driving that connection to be public with what you do. People think it's a great lifestyle, but it's hard. It's extremely hard. I feel better every time I do share my story, and that, we use the power of storytelling a lot, but it's tiring. It is extremely tiring, but I love what I do because I know the fact is that in the end of the day, yes, we don't save everybody's life, but that's not physically possible, right? But the fact is that we know that we change people's lives in a way that is positively better. So there's more positive mental health outcomes that come from what we do at Love Me, Love You. And everyone's different in how they interpret that and the experiences that come with it. But what it's done for me is actually opened up the opportunity of conversation with my 6-year-old son, which is, we talked about legacy and footprints that you want to leave on your world before. But, I asked my 6-year-old son, Alexander, do you know what daddy does? He goes, yeah. He goes, love me, love you. It's you make people feel better that are sad. And then that opens a conversation with him, right? And it's awesome. My younger son, my 3.5-year-old Lenny, who obviously doesn't get it, but he says, love me, love you. Like, that's what you do, dad. Love me, love you. Awesome. And seeing that sort of ability to have those conversations because, as a growing up, as a kid, I wouldn't have been able to have those conversations with my dad because that's not the world that we lived in. So generalising and normalising the very process to do it is the vision, right? It's normalising the process, normalising the language by doing things like this.
Just a moment away from the chat with Lance Piccioni to remind you once again that you can join me on a ride to raise money and raise awareness for Love Me, Love You. It's going to happen on Halloween, on the 31st of October. It's a Sunday from 11 a.m. There's two rides. There's a 50K and there's a 20K. The 50K is going to be a little bit more intense. The 20K is just a casual. But it's just the idea is to get on, roll the legs over. Even if you don't want to get on a bike, I'll be on Twitch streaming the ride. Hot Dub Time Machine is going to be our DJ. Going to have special guests, I'm going to be crossing to people, chatting with people over a Zoom call. It's going to be pretty fun, and I really hope you can join me. If you'd like to support me on that ride, I'm raising funds in my Instagram profile. You'll find a link in my bio. And of course, Lance Piccioni is Everesting the day before. I don't know how he's going to back up and turn around and do it again. But Lance's Instagram is LANCE_PICIO. O-A-N-E, and that's where you can support him riding his bicycle up Mount Everest virtually from his garage. It's going to be pretty sick. All right, you might hear an ad here. If you do, thank you. If not, we're back to the show.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So the programs that Love Me, Love You Run are based on your own experience. How did you go about developing these? Not everyone's going to be able to walk from Sydney to Melbourne and come to be with the rhythm and the breathing and the physicality and the time to think. How do you take what you went through and put it into a program?
Many ways. It's been a roller coaster of working through that. There's been a number of people that have been engaged with us. The initial person that helped us design the programming that we were doing originally was a lady called Maddie Clements, who is now the Director of Wellbeing for the Australian Institute of Sport. So probably as good as you'll get in the space, right? And is still a mentor of mine and an amazing lady. So working through that, so I was, you know, as I said, from that, the Buddhism reading and all the things that I was doing, I had my big list. And I went into the, I remember walking into the meeting with her after a few meetings, and I said, oh, okay, this is what I want. And I had like 65 topics. Write me a program. And she's like, oh, yeah. So this 65 topics, what you've got, is actually probably about 15 years' work. I said, okay, cool, all right, let's bring it back and then see what that is. And so developed a whole range of different programs there. And that sort of obviously evolved over time and working through what that is. And, you know, the big programs, we do two main ones, right? And it's about, we do the storytelling component, so the general awareness. You know, get in there, talk about what your experiences are, but then what can people do to understand having a more positive mental health journey than not. Okay, and that's the big one that we, a lot of stuff that we do and a lot of other people do, and it's great awareness and great work. But our big one that we do is a peer-to-peer support training program, and it's called Welfare Warrior. And we believe it's like a mental health first aid. It's like that, but we believe it's about more being more accessible with language and time and effort and sort of working or walking away from that program going, I can actually put that this into play without being confused with it all. And then we deliver that to sort of youth, right through to adults and everyone else. And, you know, as I said, it evolves over time. And that's something we're very proud of and how that works. But the big one that we're really proud of and, you know, I think for us is a difference is about what we call our bridge the gap, because having been through it before, I'm sure you would understand that seeking a mental health service or seeking help and support for a higher service, even today, you're a minimum 2 to 4 month waiting list if you're lucky.
Yeah.
If you're lucky. And when shit hits the fan, you can't wait 2 to 4 months.
Fuck no, you can't wait 2 hours.
So, yeah, so we, apart from Lifeline and the crisis services and all that sort of stuff that go through, we have a thing called Support Pathway. And what that does is actually triages people, enables people to have check-ins and counselling services in a timely manner so that they don't slip through the gap. And more people, we're working with government and other organisations to say, okay, how do we make sure people are more aware of that process? You know, this is the thing, right? So some people, everything's high risk, right? Everything's, I'm the most important issue in this world, fix me now. But some people generally just need a check-in service from an external advocate, so someone that's not in their circle. So I need help, bang, bang, what's my check-in service? What's the resource? What's the self-care plan that I need to engage in over this period of time to maybe hopefully change things that are going through? Just because I've gone through a stressful experience doesn't mean I'm automatically I've got a mental illness, but I still need support. but I still need to understand how I can be supported. So it's, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds of people who go there throughout the year. We've got sort of visions of working some, you know, full-time employees to sort of navigate that whole process and counselling service and check-ins and through tech and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, we have a target next year to have be able to service 10 to 12,000 people through a counselling check-in service and then escalate that as we move forward. So life's just challenging for a lot of people. But, you know, I'm never an expert like yourself. When you talk about mental health advocates and people in the space, I'm not an expert, but I'm surrounded by people that are.
Yeah.
And make sure that they're supported to do what they need to do.
Delivering mental health interventions at scale is that's the golden ticket for our time. Yep. You know, I think, you know, there's so much help that can be given one-on-one, but as you mentioned, 2 to 4 months is a long time to wait. So trying to find an intervention that can keep someone safe or at least get them on a slightly better pathway until they do get that time face-to-face, that's the real key to this.
And being able to be open to that through technology is the big one. Because as much as we need human connection and we need to see people face-to-face, technology has come such a long way in our ability to service that gap. Okay. You know, and whether it be through surveys and check-ins and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, having resource at hand to be able to do that, you know, so we're putting a ton of work and development and resource into making sure that people, as I said, don't slip through the gap. And working that through. And governments, we know, you know, the government's putting billions of dollars into the mental health system and trying to change things and make things better. And, you know, that'll come, you know, and we'll see the benefits of that in years to come. You're not going to see the benefits of that next week.
Yeah.
But you just got to make sure that people are being supported and have the right resource and just feel safe, which is a big one.
Yeah. Yes, you've walked from Sydney to Melbourne, but you also love to ride a bike. I love to ride a bike.
Yeah.
Tell me about Ride With Me, this massive event that's happening across the weekend. I'm doing a ride on Halloween. I'm doing a virtual ride on Halloween. I'm not Everesting. Everesting. I've got two rides going on. I've got a 50K and a 20K. Tell me about Ride With Me. Why did you start it?
The idea from the ride came from a couple of mates. The two guys that started Knights of Suburbia, Russ and Riggers, mates of mine that I played footy against as a junior. So they've been mates for a long time, connections for a long time. And they saw the walk. So we have a March With Me event. So that Sydney to Melbourne has now escalated into a day event called March With Me. And they said, can we do a bike ride version? And this was 2015. And I said, go nuts, do your thing, because me and Lycra and bikes weren't any sort of relationship at all. So, go do your thing, perfect, let's go. And, you know, we had our first ride from Warrnambool to Melbourne, which is about a 420K ride, the way that we did it over 3 days.
Solid.
And taking some unbelievable scenery. We had about 22, I think, that did that. And then it sort of became a regular thing. And then COVID last year said, well, we can't do this in person. What are we going to do? So we come up with a model to say it's about choose your own adventure. And we believe that's also about, it symbolizes the journey that is mental health as well. You know, choose your own adventure. Choices are everything you want to be, right? So, you know, we did that last year. We had 600 people across the world that took part in that event, which was amazing. You know, raised over $300,000, and it was awesome. And for us as a small organization trying to do some good work, it was a great experience to sort of put us in a position of carrying that never alone message. And I think when you know the power of cycling is not about what you do by yourself, it's actually why people do it, is to be with other people. It opens up conversations, you talk about it, you feel safe, apart from when you get hit by cars or magpies. But it's, you know, a great experience. And I finally gave in to the guys, and they kept saying, you've got to come on these events, you've got to join cycling. And I gave in 2 years ago now, and I gave myself 6 weeks to train for, we had a weekend ride, 320 kilometers and 7,000 meter climbing over the 2 days, and trained my bum off over 6 weeks and took part in that event. Little did I know that first day, we rode up to Marysville. It's a beautiful place, but we rode through snow and it was just berserk.
Wow.
And it was one of the worst experiences of my life at the time, but finishing it and coming out on the other side, it's just like it was awesome, amazing. So the ride with me is coming up. As I said, we've got over 500 people currently registered, fundraising through, and it is choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. Got a guy in Queensland that's riding 250 kilometres a day for 8 days, so he's not doing it over the weekend. I even got my son that's doing it, Alexander, who he set himself a target of riding 10 kilometres. And it is what it is, but the reason behind it is just to make sure that people are having conversations. It opens conversations. And this is what brand awareness and general awareness from these events does, is it actually opens up safe conversations for people to have. Because we still live in a society that to talk about mental health still is not as normal as saying, oh, I've got diabetes, I can't do this. Or oh, I've got a broken arm, I can't do this. These sorts of things. But living with mental illness for a lot of people, and you make a big hoo-ha about it, what it actually does is it makes that person feel more alone through their situation. So we can actually normalize that language and process and behaviors that surround the mental health system. And as a system, I talk about me as a mental health system and you as a mental health system. We can normalize that process. People have those conversations easier. They feel more supported. They feel more inclusive. They feel safe. And we know that where people perform best is where they feel safest. You know, whether that's through the work that you do, actually you feel safe in your environment, you perform better. I myself, I feel safe in my position of what I do with the Love Me, Love You, or where I'm doing on my bike, or where I'm in position with my family. If I feel safe in that position, I perform better. And that's the idea behind it, just to get people moving. Because I know you did the cycling economy report.
Far out, mate.
True.
I was blown away. 4.6 million Australians will ride a bike this week.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people riding bikes, you know. And the thing, and what's wild is like men who are nearly 50 in Lycra, which is that's the misconception. That's a tiny, tiny percentage, of people who ride bicycles. Percentage.
Yeah. And I think COVID brought that out a lot of people. Because that was our thing. You know, the experience that we were able to have over this last 18 months with, you know, my wife's got a bike, my boys have got their bikes, that was our daily experience of freedom, right?
Yeah.
And doing that. And then I think it's a very powerful thing if you allow yourself to be a part of it. And you don't have to have the fanciest of bikes. You don't have to have your $15,000 Trek or Pinarello, whatever they're called, and all these sorts of things. You just have to have something that gets you from A to B and allows you to be a part of the freedom that is.
Yeah. And there's something psychologically so wonderful. There's research into it about what it is to actually move forward. You would have found that on your walk. There's a form of therapy. I can't remember what it's called. They wave their fingers in front of your face. But it stimulates this part of your brain that gets activated from actual forward motion.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of the wind in your face, having a chat. Come on.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we talk about this a lot. It's about movement creates movement, right?
Yeah.
And even like if it's it talks about conversation capacity. So your thought process and your brain starts working through if you've actually got movement. If you actually sit in your centered place and in here and you actually think that that's going to create energy in your processes, it doesn't work. People that isolate, connect, disconnect and sort of do nothing feel like crap. And that's just the way that it is. You create movement in what you do through, you know, walk and talks, you know, cycling conversations, you know, just chatting for the position to do that. You know, it's away from the physical exercise component where the easiest, safest place that people actually, two men can have a conversation is actually in a car.
Yeah.
And it's about this process of actually not actually looking at each other.
Yeah.
And eye contact is awkward for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But sort of the more we can sort of understand that initial phase of not seeing eye contact and having those conversations and then actually being able to eyeball each other after that creates some more genuine experiences for a lot of people.
I was once told, one of the more powerful things I've been told over my time about these kind of conversations is that when it comes to men and women, there's a big difference in that men don't talk face-to-face, men talk shoulder-to-shoulder. And as long as you can organize whatever it is, if you've got to have a conversation with someone, figure something out. Like, let's go for a walk. Let's go play golf. Let's ride a bike. I've got to help me chop this tree down. Whatever it is, find something that the two of you can do together That's where the conversations happen.
It is. And I think that comes from the days of past where, you know, we talk about sort of being supporting each other through war and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, if you want to look at that analogy, it's that I'm here right side by side. We're going to do this together. Mm. It's a capacity. And we talk about people that men don't talk, but men do talk, right? And they do. We've just got different language and it's different capacity to express and understand and be able to open it up. And we talk more black and white. It's not sort of filled with colour and noise, sort of a great punctuation and all that sort of stuff, but it's that ability for us to understand. And I think this is the thing that my wife understood really well, really early, was I was talking in my process. I didn't elaborate too much onto everything that was going about, but what I said was listened to. And I think that's what people understand is that women and the society always talk about, men, can I open up more, open up more. Yeah. You're allowed to open up, but you just need to understand that your capacity is, I need to say what I need to say and I need to move on. And I believe that, and I talk like that now, as I know what I need to be said, and we can open up and we can go down different paths or conversation, but just listen to what I'm saying. Don't try and be your answer. Don't try and fill my judgment, and don't try and be anything that it is. Just let me say what I need to say. If you've got a question, you don't understand what I'm saying, ask the question. But allow me just to be.
Lance, if people want to watch you do your Everest, how do they do it?
Yeah. So I'll be putting a thing out, obviously. We're doing some lives through the old Insta and Facebook through our Love Me, Love You page. So I'll be pushing through that. But if you are wanting to join and have a bit of fun watching me sort of tongue it up the Alp for 9 times, which I think is going to take me about 14 hours with breaks, because I've also got kids to look after and sort of family things to do as well. So I'm going to sort of mangle everything in there. But just looking on Zwift, it'll be Lance Everest. So working through that. I'm looking forward to it. As I said, the challenges of life are opportunities. You got to open yourself up to those opportunities. It's not a matter of if I complete this, it's about how I complete this. So I'm looking forward to it because it's something I put into my head that this is my another tick off my list. But, you know, the same thing as I have every day. Every day is a challenge. But trying to cycle in there. But I've got the grouse set up. Got the big TV. It'll be playing the NBA or the NFL or something on the background. I'll be watching some Bachelorette reruns or something like that, mate. It's working through that. And then I think the best part for me for this experience, which will be happening with my Everest, is my kids will see it. So my oldest comes and sits, you know, on the bench next to me and you know, obviously watches the sport that I'm watching, whatever it is. It talks to me while I'm doing it. And that's the legacy that we talk about leaving with our lives is that role modeling behavior and sort of seeing that. And they don't see us sort of, as I said, sitting and having barbecues and drinking and sort of falling over and making all these silly choices because they're such sponges. They know the importance of how we talk, how we have conversations, how we need to do our exercise. And as I say to my 3-year-old, Eleni, as I said, what's your strongest muscle? And he says, your brain. And it is. And it's not about how big your biceps are, how many abs you got, all that sort of stuff, which aesthetically, all that sort of things at work, but it's your brain. And you got to allow that to be. Right? So, yeah.
Amazing, Lance. Absolute legend to have you on the show, mate. I really, really appreciate it. And over those 14 hours, I'll definitely find some time to come and shadow you up that hill, mate.
Yeah, much appreciative. So, and I'll, the thing is, mate, I'll be backing up. I'm actually joining your Halloween ride.
Oh, yeah, amazing.
Joining the Halloween ride. So,
oh, that'll be sick.
Yeah, it would be interesting. We'll see how that comes.
I've got a 20K, mate. It's just, there's a 20K, like 0 to 1 water kilo. You just jump, you know, it was super easy.
Yeah. So, that's the thing. So, like, I've worked it out that I'll probably expel about 8,500 to 9,000 calories on the Saturday.
That's a lot of eating.
Trying to work through that. And then, any opportunity to be able to join you on the Zwift, mate, and have a ride and see what it's all about and listen to the hot tub time machine. It's what it's about, right?
Tom, Hot Tub Time Machine's our DJ, and he's going to be doing it from a hotel room in Darwin. Yeah, he's on tour.
Of all places.
Tom's on tour, so he's going to sort it out. It's going to be a great ride. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a good chat.
But it's not about what happens just for the event as well. Osha. It's about, you know, for us with the nicer suburbia and the work that has been done in this space, you know, there are thousands of members of call across the country who said representing and spreading the Never Alone message. You know, everyone's got different messages, but I think that's the big thing for us. People need to know that we're here together, right?
Yeah.
You might feel like you're the only person in the world dealing with your crap and your challenges, but you've got to allow people in. And we're here to help as much as anybody else. And if you want some help, let us in. So, yeah.
There it is, Lance. Enjoy the rest of your training, mate. And thanks for your time. I'll see you on the out, mate.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Osha.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Lance Piccioni, the CEO of the Love Me, Love You Foundation, riding his real bike up a virtual Mount Everest. He's going to do that on the 30th of October. The next day, I'm riding a 50K. You can join me for that, or a 20K, which is also a part of that ride. I'd love to see you there. Just keep an eye on my socials for more details about those rides. If not, join us on the Twitch stream. I'll tell you more about that through the week, but it'd be absolutely great if you could support and get behind Lance. You can support him through his Instagram. You'll find the link to everything he does. Lance, L-A-N-C-E underscore P-I-C-I-O-A-N-E. It's just good to have a good sobriety talk with someone. I miss that, being able to have a good, you know, kind of face-to-face long-form chat about the decisions you make and the choices you make when you're in those states of mind influenced by drugs and alcohol. It was a good reminder. I'm really grateful I had Lance on the show. If anything in that conversation did bring issues up for you, please do talk to your GP if you need to talk to someone right now. Lifeline 13 11 14. Thank you so much to all the people that helped me make that show. Bree Steele on research and production support, Andy Maher, my audio producer, and of course the executive producer of my life, the woman that really runs the executive function part of my world, Rachel Barrett. You are the best. And Toe Hider, who made all the music. I'll see you on Wednesday. Got a good one for you, a good quickie on Wednesday. Until we speak then, sleep well and dream of beautiful things.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.